Miok li tapun saba campus jena Colin Fitz u dan huwa minajnejn barrani. Naqleb l-Ingliż bħas-soltu għax din essenzjila hija mismuha minn ħafna u ħafna nies internazzjonali, nies barranin li jgħixu Malta, anke nies minn pajjiżi oħrajn. Welcome to Malta Through International Eyes on Campus 103.7. You will find episodes of this series online on the Campus 103.7 website in our on-demand section under the title Minajnejn Barranin, the Maltese title. All you have to do is go to the pages, select the program. There's already been 4.5 seasons of programs, and the program will download to your downloads folder on your computer, and you can listen to it there or from whatever device you wish as a podcast. Minajnejn Barranin, Malta Through International Eyes. We have three guests in the program today, and they are interviews with people I have done here on Campus 103.7 in the last few years. They were broadcast once in various programs that I have presented, and I thought that it was a shame that they weren't being heard again. They couldn't be heard again, these interviews in which we speak about Malta. I speak to a person from Portugal and two people from the United Kingdom, who have spent various amounts of time in Malta and Gozo. So I thought I'd recycle, I'd bring back these interviews because I find them very interesting. I'm sure you will as well. The first one is with a choreographer from Portugal. Her name is Tania Carvalho, and she was here to direct a special dance presentation that was being staged in 2022. And this is the interview I had done with Tania Carvalho from Portugal. How long have you been a choreographer, Tania?
I'm a choreographer for more than 20 years, I would say. Since 97, 98, I started creating my own pieces.
Do you also dance?
I also dance my own pieces sometimes. I danced a bit in the beginning of my studies, but I never really wanted to be a dancer. I always wanted to be a choreographer or a creative, no matter what area. I could be another area. And so I started immediately doing my own shows, little by little, little shows, and I started showing up, and then I started immediately, yes.
And forgive me for asking very basic questions, but I'm not...
It's okay.
I'm not totally so well-versed on dance, but what kind of dance do you do or have you always worked on? I know there's modern contemporary dance, there's ballet, obviously, there's jazz, there's flamenco. What kind of dance do you specialize in?
We say contemporary dance, but contemporary dance, it can be so many things. It's like... when you see a cinema and you say author's cinema, it's like the dance. It's an author's dance. I say it like this because each choreographer has his own style. I mix many styles. Sometimes I even mix classical dance in the middle, like in this piece I'm showing here. There is a reminiscence from ballet. You know, there are a little bit. So each choreographer has his own style. We call it contemporary dance, but it's so vast that it's difficult to define.
Okay. And you are here in Malta on an invitation of Sfin Malta, which is the national dance organization. And you will be, you are choreographing the performance Weaving Chaos.
Weaving Chaos, yes.
What's the reason behind that name? What's the show about?
This piece is, it exists since 2014. Mm-hmm. I did it with my own dancers in 2014. It was a commission by the Biennale de Danse de Lyon. They asked me to do a piece about Homero's Odyssey, the book.
Of course.
And then I called it Weaving Chaos because the book is so chaotic and there is this weaving of Penelope. Uh-huh. And then I thought the name would be good. And it's because of that, because the book is so chaotic and also the piece, I wanted to make something chaotic but very organized at the same time, like all this travel in the sea, the winds and all this.
Indeed,
this
it's an epic poem.
Yeah, it's an epic. Yeah, it's an epic poem. That's why the title.
From Greek mythology. Yeah. Tanya, you've worked in many different European countries or even outside of Europe?
Yes, I did. I show my work around in Europe, also other places, Brazil, Canada. I know you go around when you show your work, and I work with other companies, also in France, in Portugal too, of course. So.
And what do you think of the Teatro Manuel that you will be performing
in? Teatro Manuel, I went there just to see, and it's very beautiful. I really liked it. But I'm going to work there just next week, because till now I've been working in the studios of the company.
Of course, which is in Sfin Malta.
A conference center. They have a studio there in the office. We've been working there in their own studio. They have a studio.
Have you performed or worked in big theaters in other countries?
Yes,
or historic theaters? Tell us a little bit about some of your experiences, like your most spectacular show that you feel.
I don't know. This is very hard to choose. Because I like the big theaters and I like the small theaters, I like many things. You know, I like to work with high-level technique dancers in big companies. Like I work with the Ballet de l'Opéra de Lyon or Ballet de Marseille or the National Ballet Company in Portugal. They are very highly technical dancers. Uh-huh. And I worked with these theaters, the Théâtre Châtelet, Théâtre La Ville, you know, the big theaters. But I also like to work with non-professionals, for example, and go to small studios, show, make movements for people who are non-professional and show it in little studios or little theaters. So for me, everything is in enrichment. I don't know how to say the word.
It enriches your experience.
Yes, it's good.
And it's part of your positivity as well.
And in my own pieces, sometimes I mix professional dancers with non-professionals or people who never danced. I put one or two people and they in somehow they inspire themselves, both sides. Yes, because the non-dancers, they do movement in a different way. Sometimes it's so funny or so beautiful, and the professional dancers like to see them, and the other way around.
Yes,
it's nice to have the.
Well,
it's rich.
I admire your forward-looking experimentation, as you're saying. But most of all, I admire your positivity. about dance, I know that I have friends, in fact, who work in the field of dance therapy, which I think dance is, it can be so liberating and it can help so many people, can't it, apart from being entertaining and artistic.
Yes, I never did it, but I'm sure it must be very nice, because when you work with your body, you work with yourself, you have a better conscious of who you are, where you are, or how you are.
Yes.
You feel yourself. It's like feel your body, like yourself, I mean the body. And it must, but I never did it. But I know people do it, and it works, it's good.
Yes. Yeah. If I had to ask you for a few words of encouragement or advice to our listeners who would like to get involved in dancing, or perhaps they have children who have expressed an interest in becoming a dance. In Malta, what happens mostly is kids start going to ballet or different types of dance school after school. And then eventually at I don't know, 15, 16, they can decide to take it up professionally, and quite a few Maltese have done so. But do you have some advice as an international professional choreographer for anybody listening about who wants to get involved in dance or whose children have said, I would like to become a dancer? What should they think? What should they...
They should go for it. It's like you do... At least with me, it's very intuitive. You follow your path, you know. I followed in a very intuitive way, when you like something, if you like it, you have to do it. If you really want to do it, then do it, and then you don't quit. This is the thing, not to quit. If you want to do something, and sometimes in dance, it can happen that people say, "Oh, you're not good. You cannot be a dancer, or you don't have good legs." You don't have... But don't listen. Just go for it. You know, just keep going. This is my best advice. I think is not to listen to everybody. You listen, but you just keep the things you want.
Excellent advice. Not just in dance, but good advice.
Because you will be judged all the time as a dancer.
A bit like modeling, isn't it, I think, on the catwalk. Sometimes
maybe I remember when I started, that it was hard for me. It was really hard because they told me, you cannot be a choreographer. You should be maybe a teacher. And as I always think, no, I want to be a choreographer. You know, you have to go for it. You don't listen. Just go for it.
Of course. You remind me a bit of like in football, for example, somebody who wasn't really a player, but goes straight to being a manager, or in film, somebody who becomes a director and has never been an actor. But it's the same thing. And it's totally possible, as you are proving. Is dance and the arts in Portugal, is it something that is encouraged, that is respected, that is well subsidized? Is there a healthy artistic and dance scene in Portugal?
Yeah, there is a very good artistic scene in Portugal, and very good dancers. I find very good dancers there, and also very good choreographers and creators. Mm-hmm. Of course, there is always the subsidized problems. Maybe dance is not so much supported as, for example, theater or maybe...
singing.
Theater is more, I mean, famous, but more historic. But still there are lots of support. But I think it could be more. And easier to apply, maybe. I always say it's not only in Portugal that artists are very much judged by the text they write. And this shouldn't be like this. You have to have very good writing, a good text, a good project, to have a money. And you don't have to do that. I think you should be there. I don't have a solution. This is how I always think about it. I don't know how it could be, but some artists are very good artists, and they don't know very well how to do a project and to write a very good text, you know, philosophical ways, and they don't have a way to pay a person to do that. And so their project...
And to apply for funding
that,
maybe.
If you have a very good text, it's better.
Yes, of course. You need to be a salesperson, in a way.
Yeah, a salesperson.
To attract
this is a thing that is more problematic for me, but...
If you're just the artist, you should be judged on your art.
And
helped in that way.
And even if the art is good, if you think it's not good and you are the jury, you think, okay, I don't think this is good, but is he doing an effort? Is he working? Because who am I to judge if this is good or not? Sometimes I think about these things. And I don't know. I also don't have a solution. And I also judge people. I choose dancers to work with me. So, you know, I'm doing the same. But
in dance, you get generally, or at least it used to be, more females, more girls than boys and men. Is that still a problem? Lots of males interested in being dancers? Or do you not face that problem at all?
Not
Maybe
anymore.
It's my perception.
When I was young, yes, I was having classes and there was less boys and girls. Now I'm not sure, actually. I'm not going so much to the schools, but in the professional, I see a lot of boys in the companies. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. That's good. Tell me about your experience in Malta. How long have you been here?
I was in October for 3 weeks. Now I'm here for 1 week and I'll be one more. And I love Malta.
You do? You're enjoying
Malta.
It?
I'm very happy with that time I came here, that I was invited also for the company, that is a very nice company, and I'm very happy with these dancers.
Are you talking about Sfin Malta?
Sfin Malta.
Yes, Sfin Malta,
but
yes.
But also about the country, the island. It's very nice. I've been around a little bit.
So it's your first time here?
Yeah, it's the first time.
Good. I make sure that you visit all the historic places.
Yes, I was in some of them.
Fantastic.
Yes.
and that somebody shows you around and explains things to you. Sometimes, like all countries, if you have somebody local telling you some of the secret parts and how the people live, rather than just the famous tourist places.
I've been around some places.
That's great. And I hope you meet lots of dancers and you get inspired and you inspire people, because there are a lot of dancers, a lot of great dancers, lots of dance schools in this country. Tania Carvalho.
Yes.
Am I saying that right? Carvalho?
Yeah, Carvalho.
Carvalho, there we go. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you.
Campus 103.7, Minainen Baranin, Malta through international eyes. We started off with Portugal. Let's go to the United Kingdom. Or actually, we'll stay in Malta and speak to a British person, Rachel Holloway, who has a very heart-wrenching story, but she has some very nice things to say about Malta's health system, amongst other things. Rachel used to live here. She had to leave Malta for medical reasons. And you can hear all about her story, the books she has published, and her experiences in Malta over the next few minutes. Rachel Holloway. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, good morning.
Rachel Holloway, author of the book At War With My Mind.
Yes.
Now, let's get the elephant in the room out of the way. At War With My Mind, that's a dramatic title.
Yeah.
But there's a reason for that, and It's also a popular book on Amazon for a reason. So could you tell us a little bit about why you called your book, which is all about your experiences, At War With My Mind?
I actually changed the title. It was meant to be called Nine Lives, but then with my condition now, as you know about now, I surpassed nine lives. And then I thought At War With My Mind is something I think everyone can resonate with. And I changed it in COVID because I think in COVID everyone realised that they struggle and they're suffering, and people started suffering with mental health a lot more. Mm. So it's a title that I think could hit home, and that is what mental health is like. It's like having a bully in your head.
But Rachel, I really thank you for being so open and willing to speak, because I'm going to be quite direct.
Yep.
It's way beyond mental health, the conditions that you suffer from.
Now, yes, yeah.
Could you tell us what these conditions
so are? So I'm starting my second book. I'm halfway through At War With My Body because I now have a connective tissue collagen disorder that affects my body. So my mental health illness covered up this rare disease. So since 14, I've sort of spent half my life in hospital.
Gosh. Yes, you have a problem with cold, I believe.
It's a part of it. I have something called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So it affects every part of my body. I don't have a minute without pain. So chronic pain is huge and really tiring to live with. But I can deal with the pain, osteoporosis, arthritis, you name it, I have it. But the temperature is I'm powerless against. So, yeah, the cold.
And you can't just heat a room with an air conditioner. You need special
heaters. I wish. I've tried everything. I need infrared heaters, but even that's not quite enough. It'll keep me going for a few days, but then I'll slowly get quite sick and end up in hospital. So.
And that's, in fact, you've lived in Malta for 5 years, but you've spent the winters in other countries.
Last winter I did. The other winters I've spent in Malta Day Hospital.
Okay, so you went to New Zealand, but you've come back. But now you have to move away from Malta for the winters. And your five-year journey here is going to be ending. So
I am really struggling with that because I don't want to leave. I love Malta. It's home for me. I spent most of my UK life unwell. So Malta became home, my business, my charity and the people, which we were talking about. I love the people. But I tried to change country to have two bases, one winter, one summer, but it's been absolutely exhausting. And I hope everyone understands that that's not a way I can live my whole life.
How did you end up here?
I had 6 to 8 weeks to leave the UK because I was so unwell with the cold temperatures and the doctors said I needed to go to a warmer climate. And when I researched the whole world, obviously Malta, firstly, I didn't need visa and it was English speaking. But when I put onto the like Facebook groups, the support straight away was amazing. So I felt safe coming to a community because I'm moving on my own. I'd spent most of my teenage life in hospital. I hadn't grown up yet. So it was quite a scary thing to do.
And you were telling me while the song was playing how you had a lot of good care at Malta Day.
Amazing. The medical system in Malta has changed my life. They gave me my diagnosis. It's incurable, so it doesn't make me better. There isn't a treatment yet for it, but giving me that diagnosis and not giving up on me is I can manage it. So, and I can live.
So they recognised, they discovered what was wrong with you?
Eventually, I had over 600 blood tests, 25 scans, 4 admissions. I was tested beyond belief, but they didn't give up.
And how old are you, Rachel?
30, going on 31.
30, I mean, just a young person full of life, full of, you know, potential energy, and you have to live with all these conditions.
Yeah.
You don't just, you're not looking for pity.
No.
I mean, you write a book, you organise all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Walk and Talk, for example. Yeah. This is a charity you've set up.
Can you
tell us about that?
So I set that up in Malta 4 years ago, and it's basically inviting people to come join me for a walk along with other volunteers and professionals. And we offer people mental health support whilst walking in nature. And it's people who genuinely understand. So as you know, I talk about my illness quite openly.
Yeah.
And that just helps others to open up quite easily as well, and it's just worked, and it's really kicked off. We're a VO now, we run fundraising events, and it's amazing.
Fantastic. So Walk and Talk, it's a page on Facebook.
Yeah, that will carry on as well when I leave.
Your legacy will remain. So it's a charity organization, Walk and Talk. Listeners, you can check out Facebook and find the page Walk and Talk.
If you see a bumblebee, that's us. There's bumblebees everywhere. That will be me.
the symbol, yes, as you say, is of a bumblebee. So Walk and Talk. And your book is called At War With My Mind. You don't really get much assistance because your condition is so rare.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us about, like, so you don't get any, I don't know, because your condition is rare, it's difficult to get some financial assistance.
Yeah. So there's not like a medicine. It's not medicine that they're providing for me because that doesn't exist yet. So obviously all the flights going to Thailand, New Zealand, now Gran Canaria, people sort of say to me, you're so lucky. Actually having to give up my house, having to sell my car, having to work. My break in the year is my change in country. As soon as I land, I have to try and find ways to work again and get the money back to afford it. But it literally saves my life. So I don't have a choice. There's a lot of pressure.
You're a Pilates instructor.
I am, yeah.
All right, so you work hard on that. One thing you'd really like to get across to people, as we said earlier, it's not about pity. It's not about saying, oh, poor Rachel.
No.
It's because I'm looking at you here. You're a very attractive 30-year-old, you know, on the outside, there doesn't seem to be much wrong with you.
No.
But
no.
There is stuff wrong with you.
Yeah,
there is stuff wrong with everybody has big or small problems. And you have a message that you'd like to bring across, right?
Yeah, my dad actually said to me the other day, if there was a lineup of people in a medical file, there was no way people would put my medical file to me, because I am happy, genuinely. I smile, I go around, I travel. So people sometimes don't even believe me that I'm in pain or suffer with the cold. And you actually just don't know what people are dealing with. You don't know if they've had bad news that morning. If you're on the roads and someone's had a bit of road rage at you, they might have got the worst news that morning. So just kind of be kind to people, be understanding, just
be patient.
Be patient. Everyone's going through something that we don't know about. And that's why I speak out, because like we say, I do not look like I've got this sickness. And actually, behind the scenes, I'm very unwell. So just be kind, just be understanding, and just help each other through this quite stressful life, let's face it.
And when we're on social media, let's not shoot from the hip and just
react. Yeah, because you're behind a screen doesn't mean that you can say what you like.
Let's not criticize automatically and just let's try and understand the other point of view.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know what's happened in that person's day or life. Mm-hmm, so,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. Great message. Let's go back to your, did you say 10 years of anorexia?
Yeah.
Now, that's another misunderstood condition, isn't it?
Hugely so, yes. It's nothing to do with wanting to look thin or become underweight at all. It's mental health illness, like alcohol addiction, like drugs, like depression. It's the same umbrella. It's suffering. It's not being able to cope with life. And almost, self-destruction, self-harm.
So what did you receive help for that condition?
Yeah, I was in hospital for 5 years. So, a year at a time, year relapse.
That was back in the
relapse.
UK.
That was in the UK. Yeah. That's why I got diagnosed so late with this illness, because that covered up all of the symptoms of my illness now.
So the illness that we're talking about, what's the name of this rare?
Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Gosh.
I had never heard of it either until I came here.
Let's hear it again. Maybe people want to research about it.
Yeah, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, EDS. You'll still find there.
Okay. And what advice, probably possibly people listening to us now, people who know someone who's going through the anorexia nervosa situation, do you have any advice to give?
Again, just being understanding that it's not just about eating, it's not about weight. So just try and find what's going on. They could be being bullied, they could be suffering with something externally in life. Get a therapist, get support, because it's a really horrible illness, and I lost some really close friends to this illness, which is quite difficult.
At least as opposed to EDS, it is recognised, it's been recognised
more
for a while.
So now as well,
more so now, and there is treatment.
Yeah, and I do want to say the book is more for people who are caring for someone suffering. It can be for someone suffering as well, but it's very honest. It's the journals I kept, so it's quite hard-hitting. But it's to allow people caring for someone to understand what's happening inside their mind, and that can help them understand why they're being the way they are and what they can do to support.
So, Rachel Holway, that's Holway with an E.
Yes.
Rachel, and it's a Rachel, it's R-A-C-H-A-E-L.
Yes.
Rachel.
Parents gave me a very difficult name.
Rachel Holway, At War With My Mind. It's a book available on Amazon. You're writing a second book, At War With My Body.
Yeah. And it was translated into Italian yesterday, and it was released. So that's exciting.
Also, you can look out for Walk and Talk and the Bumblebee symbol on Facebook, the group. The Walk and Talk, I mean, it's basically, it does what it says on the tin.
Exactly, yeah.
And walking and talking is very good for mental health.
It works.
Yeah. Rachel Holway, it seems to me like despite all your issues and problems, and you were very complimentary about Mater Dei Hospital and our health system here. But you seem to love Malta.
Yeah, I was going to say complimentary about Malta. And the last few days, I'll probably go again, I just keep crying because I'm not ready to say goodbye to Malta. Mm-hmm. It'll always be home, and just everyone that's supported. And just for the last 5 years, everyone that's helped me in Malta, just thank you so much.
So we've had Tania Carvalho from Portugal, Rachel Holloway from the United Kingdom, and her story about the very rare medical condition from which she suffers. Now some opinions about Malta from a frequent visitor and also a person whose father had a connection to Malta. He's also a bit of a VIP, somebody quite well known, particularly in automotive circles. He's the engineer and designer from the car industry, Professor Peter Stevens, most famous for his work on the famous McLaren F1 car. And he had made a donation of one of his sketches to an auction that had been held in Malta in 2023 that was raising funds for the restoration of St. Paul's Pro-Cathedral in Valletta, the Anglican cathedral with the spire that is so recognisable. During the interview, we mention the auction, but of course the auction is over and done with and the cathedral has been restored, so ignore the bits about the auction as such, but I think you'll find what Peter had to say about Malta very, very interesting. Professor Peter Stevens, it's a pleasure to have you with us here on Campus 103.7, the University of Malta's radio station.
Well, it's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
And the reason, the main reason we decided to do this interview and you accepted is that there's a connection to Malta in the sense that you donated one of your signed sketches of one of your greatest creations, shall we say, to the auction, which will raise funds for the restoration of St. Paul's Anglican cathedral, pro-cathedral, in Valletta.
That's not by any means my only link to Malta, you know?
Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I mean, my godfather, who's not with us now, But during Second World War, he flew supplies in Blenheim's into Malta, into the old airfield.
Yes.
And he told me stories about how dramatic that was and the extraordinary efforts of the Maltese people, you know, who they would, I mean, I'll tell you just briefly the story. They would set off from Gibraltar, you know, and when they were about 200 miles from Malta,
yes,
they would circle around because there would have been a bombing raid going on.
From Sicily.
As soon as the raid had finished, they absolutely flat out to Malta. And as he said, there were thousands of people with baskets full of stones filling in the holes in the runways.
Indeed. Oh, wow.
You know, so, and then those people with the baskets then would help unload the plane.
Of course.
The quickest they could, and they'd be off and away before the next raid arrived. So, and he told me those tales, which was fantastic.
So this would have been in the worst part of the war when the convoys weren't getting through and the only trickle of supplies coming through were from submarines and a couple of destroyers making a quick run and your godfather piloting planes, supply planes coming in and leaving as soon as possible, not to get caught in the air raids.
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
definitely. But, I mean, since then, I've come and I've been a judge in the Valletta Concours for a good few years now.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and I've holidayed on Gozo. And, in fact, I was in Malta just 2 weeks ago talking to a friend of mine about a possible client for a project. So, yeah, there's a lot of links. And it's
indeed.
That's why it's a delight to be able to do something for this this fantastically worthwhile charity auction, I must say.
Indeed. Yep. There's been a program of events and fundraising for the last few years, and we've had a number of Maltese and international, including British personalities who have donated things or given lectures. We had Max Hastings, the historian and author of so many books, give a special lecture about the Operation Pedestal, and funds were raised thanks to that.
No, I love, in fact, I've looked through the list, you know. I mean, I'm kind of honored to be in such a list of wonderful things, you know, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I should looking on the auction myself on the 30th and see, you know.
Fantastic. Yeah. But it's great to be speaking to you, Professor Stevens, Peter Stevens. People, you can be defined, or your title would be, a British car designer, at least according to Wikipedia and many biographies. But you're so much more than that. I mean, you have worked with so many different companies. You've designed so many interesting things. What would you say are your crowning achievements?
Do you know, it's always a funny thing that, because, I mean, obviously people know the McLaren F1 because they just know about it, you know. But I also, for example, did some work in India with the company Mahindra, and we worked on, which sounds strange to say, equally satisfying, a little rural utility vehicle, which is a little kind of pickup that could be bought by a village and shared by the village. And it could be a pickup, it could be a little bus, it could be a little van, it could even be a small ambulance. I'm a tiny vehicle, you know. But to me, I get almost equal satisfaction.
Of course.
Because when I've been to India and I see these things in a little rural village, you know, and that's really nice because it's, you know.
It's probably very economical and easy to operate. So some of the sort of more distant villages can have transportation finally.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
I mean, it's fine to say with the McLaren, well, there's 100 people who are very happy with their car, you know. I like to think that in India there are 10,000 who are happy with their little thing. You know?
Indeed.
It's a funny balance that. It's equally nice.
But for those perhaps listening who are not aware, the McLaren F1 is a road car. built by the company that is also known for Formula One participation. And for many years, it was the fastest road car in the world. And it's obviously a massively collectible car nowadays, worth millions. Famous people such as Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean, owns one or possibly two, I believe. Is it
George Harrison had one?
The Pink Floyd drummer, Nick Mason, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and well, quite a few in America, and very expensive in America. So the people have to be rich and famous to own one now. I mean, that's a funny thing. We never thought of the car like that when we were designing it. I mean, we wanted to do the best possible car that we could. If as a result of it being the best we could do, it also turned out to be the fastest, you know, that was because the prime objective wasn't to make the fastest car, but if you make what you think is the best car, then pretty fair chance it will turn out fast. And the record speed that we did on VW's Eralesen track with a friend of mine driving, you know, and that was, I wasn't there, but he had phoned me up and asked a bit of advice, you know, about setting up the car. And it was a strange feeling. So he then said, oh, that'll be all right then. I said, yeah, it'll be fine. And he said, all right, I'll phone you this evening. And I suddenly had this thought, because he's a really good friend of mine. And I've just said to him, sitting in my chair, in my studio, you know, what I'm telling you means the car will be fine. And then he'll go out and do, in miles an hour, 246 miles an hour.
Wow.
Which is scarily fast.
Indeed. Indeed.
Admit, you know. And there's a little bit of video of him doing this, you know, and it's the difference between race drivers and us normal human beings is that he is totally cool when he's driving it. And he has the spare mental capacity both to be reading out the speed as it's gathering speed, you know, but also to say what the oil temperature was, you know, what the water temperature was. And just at the end of it, he said, oh, and the fuel warning light has just come on. Yeah. So I know he's got all that wonderful capacity to do the other things, you know?
Yes.
And well, I just still love that.
Amazing. Of course, we're not encouraging people to drive too fast on them on proper roads. We're just celebrating the achievements that humankind has made in the field of engineering and design, including, in this case, creating a machine that can go so fast on land and for many years was the fastest thing that could be driven around a racetrack safely, of course.
That's it. And, I mean, the point about the speed is not that you will ever use that speed if you're a normal customer, but what it means is the systems that allow for that speed safely are there for you all the time, even if you're just going 100 kilometers an hour, you know, to go to the beach or the countryside or something. All those systems that look after you continue to look after you really well at what we would call sensible speed.
Indeed. This might interest our engineering students here at the University of Malta, where Campus 103.7 is based. I'm interviewing Professor Peter Stevens, a famous British car designer who's donating a signed print of his most famous creation, the McLaren F1 car, to be auctioned off for the auction to raise funds for the restoration of St. Paul's Anglican Cathedral in Valletta. You're a car designer. You went to Central St. Martin's School of Art and the Royal College of Art.
Yep.
But, I mean, a car is a machine. So how does design and engineering, how do they come together?
If a car comes out really well as a piece of design, that's because a team, a very small team in McLaren's case with that car, worked together. I mean, there still is a little bit in the industry where the enemy are the guys down the corridor. So if you're a designer, you say, the engineers are ruining my great ideas.
Yes.
If you're an engineer, you say, oh, those wretched stylists, they just want to make something looks all right. And so I always believed, you know, that being a really close-knit member of a team is the way that those things happen well. And I'm with the McLaren, most of the guys who worked on the project, we're still great friends, you know, and we still meet and laugh, and we remember how fascinating it was. Because I tell you, at the time, it was very hard work, you know. We were all probably working harder than we had done in previous jobs, you know.
Yes.
And we couldn't stand back far enough from the project to sort of see what we'd achieved. I mean, it sounds silly to say, we know it was okay, we know it was fast, you know, but we didn't realize at the time, you know, what a landmark it would be in terms of high performance.
Of course, the biggest enemies are always the accountants.
Well, this is true. Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, these days, there is a conservatism because what it now costs to do a new car, you know, I mean, if you're talking S-Class Mercedes or something, it's probably 3 billion euros. So, in other words, the investment you're putting at risk by possibly making a mistake, you know, especially in the aesthetic, if you think the direction is to be, and some cars now look so aggressive, you think if you stop, they could eat a dog, you know, the face is kind of angry, you know, and so there is a risk. And I think it has made the industry a bit risk-averse, to be honest.
Oh, interesting. You know? And for the benefit of our listeners, particularly students, who are just starting off perhaps their university career, what would you recommend that they study if somebody wants to become like you, a designer in the car industry?
Well, and what you have to remember is every single aspect of everything we see and touch and experience has been designed. Now, some of the horrible things mean they've been badly designed, but they've still been designed, you know. So everything requires designing of some sort. These days, I think the job of students, a lot of it, is to demand from their tutors, if you like, you know, more information, you know, more discussion about design, because the way that design has become, it's become really separated from the engineering. It's been separated from the aerodynamics, you know. And it's important, if you're going to be a designer, to say, I'd like to know about this. I want to know about that, you know. But I'm just thinking as we're talking, next time in Malta, I should come and talk to the students in the university.
That would be wonderful.
Because I thoroughly enjoy that, you know, because, my task still is to challenge young people to think ahead, think very broadly, you know, because that's the way we'll get the progress. So that kind of thing would be fun. But it is necessary, really, truly, to be demanding, you know, and say, okay, I'm doing design in a visual sense, but I'd like to learn a bit about aerodynamics so that somebody doesn't take my project away and say, I've fixed it, aerodynamics is perfect. And you get it back and it's horrible. You know? That's the kind of thing we have to avoid. Indeed. For sure.
It's amazing how you worked in the different aspects of automotive design and engineering, whether it's for designing tiny little cars or massive projects. You even worked in the United States, I see here, and you've done consultancy for BMW, Williams, and Toyota. Yeah. It's an amazing CV, and it'll be wonderful to have you here in Malta again when you next visit, and maybe even we'll get you here at the university to give a lecture.
It would be cool. It would absolutely. Because with BMW, I worked on the Le Mans car, the one that won in 1999 at Le Mans, you know, which was, and that's a glorious thing because I'm fascinated by Le Mans. You know, the first time I went to Le Mans with a friend of mine and we took a little Porsche 924 GTR and we didn't qualify, you know, because we knew nothing. We didn't know you needed a separate signaling crew at the far end of the circuit. We didn't know you needed to effectively build your own pit. You just got this empty room that smelt of urine, you know, and you had to build your tables and everything in there. So you had to go to the local Leroy Merlin, which was the hardware shop, You know, and when I got back from there, I wrote myself a note to be opened on New Year's Day, and it said, "Don't go back to Le Mans." Instead of which, I went back 19 times.
19 times. Le Mans, of course, the famous 24-hour race in France. Legendary. And so you participated in it 19 times?
With teams, working in various roles teams, yeah.
Amazing.
You know, and we with a private Porsche 956, we came second behind the work-supported car that won.
Well done.
And we're just like 4 minutes behind at the end. You know,
that's amazing.
Of course, with the BMW, we won. With the McLaren F1, you know, that won as well. It's seductive, you know.
Yes. You've also done work for Subaru for the World Rally Cars, the Imprezas. Very popular in Malta among the boy racer community.
Well, they're great, you know. I mean, I still like Subarus. I've got the flat six Legacy Outback, you know, which is the engine was a joint venture with Subaru and Porsche, the flat six, and it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I haven't cured myself of that.
So, Professor Peter Stevens, let's conclude the final push for the final amount of funds needed to conclude the restoration of St. Paul's Anglican Cathedral. You are donating one of your prints.
Yeah. Yes, I am. I did. In fact, what happened was, the materials we used when I drew the sketches for the car, those materials were, if you put a drawing in the sunlight in about 6 months, because the magic marker ink would disappear and the drawing would disappear. So I made a print of one of my favorite of the sketches done during the project. And this is the artist's proof, so it's one of one, which is what the print is, and which is why I'm very happy to give that. I know there's loads of car enthusiasts in Malta, but also other people who will be online. But the other thing is that, I mean, Valletta to me is startling city, extraordinary city, you know. Every time I'm there, I get up terribly early to try and be first in line to see the Caravaggio, you know, because those paintings are extraordinary. But all of those buildings, I mean, they are wonderful. They're quite extraordinary, you know, and they deserve to be there forever. We can't say whether they would be there forever, but they absolutely deserve the preservation and restoration, which seems to be, I mean, I'm not being patronizing, the craftsmanship applied to those buildings now is fantastic. It's like the craftsmanship applied to restoring cars. I mean, the reputation Malta has for all of that kind of thing, you know. And I think caring for its history is, well, it's so fundamental, you know. I mean, there is a little Arabic saying, how can we know where we should be going if we don't know where we've come from? You know, and knowing where you've come from is part of that history of the buildings, you know. So to me, I mean, it's something that is very, very dear to my heart, actually.
What a pleasure it's been. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, it's a delight. Absolute delight.
Yeah. Thank you.
And hopefully we'll see you there when I see the students. I'm going to make a point of doing that.
We'll sort something out for you. I'll speak to people right after this interview. And next time you're over, we'll see you here at the university and also at the Valletta Concours, hopefully, the car show.
No, you definitely will. They are bullying me already for my dates when I'm coming out.
Fantastic.
But I like to come early because I get up early and go Caravaggio again.
Absolutely.
Okay, terrific.
It's so wonderful to speak to someone of your stature and all you've achieved, but also for the fact that you love Malta so much.
Thank you. Bye then.
And with our three interviews done and dusted, don't forget the interview with Professor Peter Stevens there that mentioned an auction related to the restoration of the Anglican Cathedral in Valletta that has been concluded, and the auction happened a couple of years ago. But I hope you found what Professor Peter Stevens had to say about Malta interesting and useful. And of course, relevant to this program. Malta Through International Eyes will return today week at the same time on Campus 103.7, and eventually the program will also be uploaded to our website. Campus 103.7, I'm Colin Fitz, saying thank you for tuning in. Thank you.